Hi, welcome to the Universal Sisterhood podcast. We're hoping to create a place where women can delve deeper, lift their gaze higher, live freer, laugh louder, smile brighter, and be the authentic woman they were designed to be. Every human heart is created to be known, loved, and understood. So this is the place where women can share their stories. So put your crown on. Let's get chatting. Welcome to episode 5. Just a little disclaimer. Some parts of this episode might be a little bit sensitive to small ears. So if you have little ones in the car, it may not be the place to play it. Having said that, sit down with a cup of coffee and listen to the podcast. Enjoy. Hi, Liv. How are you?
Good morning, Jess. I'm well. Yourself?
Yeah, good. Holidays has begun in our house, so I sat in bed yesterday and read a book. The dog's trying to get in.
Lucky you. I was working yesterday, but today I've got the day off and I've now got 3 weeks off, so it's looking good.
Excellent. Today we're talking with Julie James, who is a mother of 10. She's been married for how many years?
41. Wow. 42, I think.
That's putting you on the spot. Yeah. Mm.
And it's showing your age. You don't look a day over 40.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Yes, well, I was a wild teenager. My parents had their marriage had broken up and I was rebelling. So I had been, my friends were all on drugs and I decided to try and make a break. And they said, "Oh, just come out with us one more time." And they ended up forcing LSD onto me. And in my hallucinations, I found that I was in a place that looked like what you'd think maybe hell was, and that I didn't actually believe in hell at that time, and but they wouldn't take me home, and I thought, okay, maybe there's maybe if hell does exist, there is a God and there is a heaven. And I just said, "Well, look, God, if you exist, please get me out of here and give me another chance." And the next thing, they dropped me back home and they said, "Julie, if you tell anybody what happened today, we'll burn your house down with you in it." Mm. So
you're not the best friends to have.
So I woke up the next morning severely depressed and felt nobody loved me, poor me. And I was actually thinking how if I just wanted to take my life because I hadn't found real happiness. Mm-hmm. And my brother walked in and he was 14. I was about 16. And he said, "Julie, if you want to find happiness, read the Bible." And he just walked out. And we weren't allowed to talk about God in our homes.
So that wasn't God's handiwork.
No. Wow. So I thought, oh, my gosh, maybe God is giving me another chance. Maybe, you know, he doesn't want me to take my life. I don't know. Maybe I should just look at the Bible before I decide how to take my life. Mm-hmm. And so I'd had one sitting on my shelf from school from years before and just opened it up at Genesis, read the story of Adam and Eve and how they'd rebelled against God's plan and for them to live in paradise. Mm. And I just saw what mess we'd made our world into. And basically I said, "Okay, God, I believe that you exist, but all I need to know is that you love me, because why do you want to live if nobody loves you?" And at that stage, nobody did that, I thought. So the next thing I found, felt these arms wrapping around me, and I just felt totally immersed in this unbelievable love that I can't describe. And then when it finished, I just got out of bed. I knelt down on my knees and I just started crying, and I just felt so humble in front of this amazing love and power. And it, from that day onwards, I decided to do something with my life, and I wanted to help others. I thought, I was thinking to work in India with the poor, and but I met my husband. We got married, had 10 children, which was none of my plan. I never wanted to marry. I'd never seen a happy marriage. And definitely not have children, because I'd only seen unhappy children and divorced families. So, but I decided, well, I was going to make do something. I was never going to do let my marriage end in like the way my parents did. But there was a catch to that, and I think it happened when my dad made mum have an abortion, and she didn't want to, but she felt if she didn't, he may abandon her with 4 children. So,
were you aware of this?
Not at all. No, this was probably when I was maybe 10 years old. Anyway, but she was suffering a lot with depression, and when I put it all together, I think that she, she told me 40 years down the track that she had not wanted to have the abortion, and she wished that somebody would stop her. Mm. And even at the abortion clinic, if somebody had said to her, there's another option, somebody we can support you, she would never have gone through with it. And since that day, she said she basically didn't want to live. She didn't feel worthy to live. Mm. Anyway, so.
Wow. Mm.
Beautiful.
I did pregnancy counselling for a few years, and I noticed that a lot of the callers were post-abortion trauma, women who had post-abortion trauma, and it could have been 40, as you said, years ago, and they still carry this massive burden.
Yeah.
And they don't understand why they're aching or why they're hurting, and they because they've always been told that it's nothing, it's a lump of cells, you'll get on with your life.
Mm.
And society tells you that to be a true woman, it means to be self-assertive. And it's so sad that today self-assertiveness and being an independent woman is giving us permission to kill our children.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's the form of independence that we've been given, is the ability to choose whether we kill our children or let them live.
Mm.
I mean, it has to affect you personally, you know, every person and society. Liv, have you got any thoughts?
I just saw a bumper sticker the other day, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it was something like, you know, we're all about, society is all about women's choice, but what about the choice of a baby?
Hmm.
And, you know, it got me thinking. But just to give you a bit of a background on my, you know, where I come from on the stance of abortion, I think with anything, with the faith especially, you have to at some point in your life make it your own. And, you know, we've got the Ten Commandments to help guide us through life. But unless you really make it your own and, you know, you're just sort of a cradle Catholic. And I was at a leadership talk for leaders of Christian schools in Sydney. This was, 25 years ago. And there was a speaker there, and there were speakers from all over the world on people who had overcome adversity, and there was one girl there called Gianna Jensen, and she was an American pro-lifer and a disability rights activist, and she was the result of a failed saline abortion, and her mum was 17. And she said she has cerebral palsy as a result, which affects your movement, but she describes her cerebral palsy as a tremendous gift. And it was that moment that was my clearest moment. Like, I know the Catholic Church is against abortion and we support life from conception to death, to natural death. But it was that moment, hearing this girl's story, that it became really clear in my head, the Church's stance on abortion. That was when I thought, yep, I have to do something about this.
But you also were a nurse.
Yeah. So Look, after I heard Gianna speak, I did do sidewalk counselling for a little bit, and I know there's a big hoo-ha in the media at the moment about it, but I can honestly say that it was very peaceful on the side of the Pacific Highway all those years ago, but there was a lot of anger from motorists driving past and horns and things like that. Then I sort of got caught up in life and I didn't do counselling for a long time. And then I got to uni and I did nursing, and I was a first-year nursing student on a midwifery prac, and I had been waiting all day for this poor young girl to labour, and it was taking a lifetime.
We all know that. How many births between us? 20? Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
But she was having an induced abortion.
Yes. So, well, at the time, no, this was a different one. So okay. I was waiting for this girl to labour, and it was taking forever, and I was just doing uni notes and things. And then the head nurse came to me and said, oh, well, if you're bored, if you don't have anything else to do, why don't you come and look at why don't you come and look at placenta and membranes? They were the exact words she used. So for me, placenta and membranes was the afterbirth, because as you know, they have to check your afterbirth that nothing's left. So I presume that's what I was looking at, and I scrubbed up, put gloves on and walked into this room, and she just said, oh, it's over there in the red bucket. And I went over and lifted the lid off, and there was this perfect little boy in the bucket, and it just shattered me. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, can I baptize him?
How big was he?
Well, this is what made me really sad. She said, oh, he was only 14 weeks, and she was sort of making out that it was okay because he was so young. But he was bigger than the size of my hand, you know, from wrist to fingertips.
More than 14 weeks.
Yeah, and because I had done sidewalk counselling, I know that is at least 24 weeks, that size. But he was perfectly formed. He had fingers, toes, penis, eyes, you know, everything was formed. Everything was perfectly formed. And I was in so much shock, I couldn't even show my anger to this woman, because she obviously did it for the shock factor of a first year, a uni student. And she...
Was that even legal back then?
No, I don't think 24? So. And I was
young. She said 14 weeks, didn't she?
Yeah. But I was so young, and I just didn't have the courage to say anything. I was speechless.
Yeah.
And she picked him up and turned him over, and she said, oh, he had spina bifida, that's why. And he had the tiniest little split in his back. It was just like a little red mark along his spine. And I was just overcome with this, not anger at all towards the mother, just sadness. And I just kept thinking, is she in this hospital, you know? And there was babies being born all around us, and that cry of pain and sheer joy, you know, and I thought, is she listening to this? You know, I just couldn't help, I couldn't get that mother out of my head, and it wasn't, and I think that's what the media portrays sidewalk counsellors. We've got this anger towards mothers for doing it, and it's not like that. We're there to help them as much as we are to help the children, the unborn babies. And, yeah, I've never forgotten. And it was the very next day. I told Mum when I went home, but I struggled to report it. You know, I was just in shock. And but the very next day I got I think it must have been on a news report. I don't think it was an inbox email, but you know that story of the doctor. It's a famous image of a doctor operating on a baby in utero who has spina bifida. The hands coming, he's made an incision, and the hands coming through the belly and holding onto the doctor's finger. And that baby had spina bifida, and he was able to operate and put it back in and finish gestation. And I just thought, wow, you know, if only that mother knew that there was hope.
Yeah. Abortion always brings death to the child, but it also brings a certain type of numbness and death, I suppose, to the parents. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying with your mother.
Well, I'd put it in the fact that, in a way, Mum was saying that her soul had died.
Yeah.
With that
baby. She religious at all? No.
No, she was, both my parents were anti-Christian.
Yep.
So.
But she felt that, I mean, it's natural, it's human nature.
It is. It's.
We go against nature.
Yeah.
And we're told that we can do whatever we want to our bodies, it's our choice.
But unfortunately, the choice is, it's not a good one. Mm. Like it's not going to bring a solution to the problem.
No. Well, I've taken in women. Well, I did sidewalk counselling also, and telephone counselling. And the thing I was finding was a lot of women had to get out of their situation to continue with the pregnancy. They had to get away from the father because they would be bashed, or some of them, you've heard of women being killed, you know.
Yeah.
So basically I was struggling to find accommodation for them and unable to find anything. Everything was full and a lot of places were closing down because of a lack of funding. So I ended up over the years taking in about 6 women into my home, and they're following through, you know, well, getting, just people would donate money to me and would get them through their pregnancies. And in many cases we thought they were going to have to give up their children, but somehow in the end they've all, bar one, have ended up keeping their children with support from people, not necessarily
family?
Not necessarily family, no, but other people who saw, you know, the value in letting this mother keep the child and giving her support. Some of them were from a pro-life background sort of thing, and they've taken these young mothers. And one mother was an alcoholic. She was 45 when she had the baby. Her other 5 children had been taken off her because of the alcohol. She wasn't able to care for them. And so it was like pretty desperate situation. The doctor, her GP said, as soon as he said, I'm reporting you to docs, you're going to have an abortion, da-da-da-da. And after talking to me, she said, no, after going through it, she said, I was adopted. I had a beautiful adoptive parents, and she said, I'm going to adopt, even though the father of the baby said, you either abort or keep the baby, you're not giving it away. Because the last pregnancy, the baby had been given away to some distant relatives, and he was really upset about that. But he actually broke her arm before she got pregnant, so he was violent, you know. It was just so sad. But so in the end, she hasn't got the little boy, but she's a member of the family's got him. And once she goes through rehab, which she's been coming in and out of rehab, but she's going in for 9 months this time, and if she does, she'll be able to get her son back. And another one was an overseas student who, she was deported back to China because she overstayed her visa to have the baby. The father had locked her out of the house and changed the locks on the house, so she was homeless. And so she lived with us, and then he was 15 months old, and they said, you know, they'll put her into detention if she doesn't go home. And she couldn't take this baby back because she had a child already in China as a single mum. That child's not recognised as a human being or a citizen or anything. So she just left the baby with me and went back to China. So I had this beautiful little baby boy, but in the end the father, who denied he was the father, refused to have DNA testing. Once the mother went back to China, decided to come and visit him, fell in love with him, and now after 3 years of gradually breaking him into being a father, he's now taken this little boy.
Wow,
good story. So,
anyway.
You're a good woman.
Oh, well, I get a lot of pleasure out of seeing, you know, lives.
Taken care of.
Yeah.
I know, but abortion kind of, imagine how many people that haven't been born that should have been born, and families that don't exist now because of abortion, and, you know, aunties and uncles that could have been, well, should have been here. Well, I mean, whole generations are kind of missing.
Well, my mother also had an abortion when she was raped as a teenager. So I've got 2 siblings missing, and if they had even half the children I had, that would be 10 children between them.
Yeah.
And then if they had children, like I've got 9 grandchildren, so say they had 5 grandchildren, like it's just generations that are missing from and I often think like those siblings, like what sort of relationship would I have with them?
Because you only have one brother,
I've got
that right?
Three brothers. But two of my brothers have had all their children aborted because they grew up in that mentality, you know. So
abortion has really affected your family on a very personal level.
And they're both very unhappy, those two brothers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very sad.
People always say the pro-life movement, are only concerned about the baby, and it's always focused on the baby. You're killing the baby, and they're you know, shoving maimed babies in people's faces and pictures of.
Mm.
But they don't understand that we really are about the woman, like the baby and the mother. Mm. I mean, you taking six women into your home, you know, shows that the empathy there is for both mother and
exactly,
which really is.
If you don't care for the
feminism,
mother.
Isn't it? Like we care for the woman, we care for the mother.
Yeah. And
what do you have to say to? Do you want to speak about that? You know, the fact that we're kind of seen as being anti-feminist when really we uphold women.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't have 10 children if I hadn't seen that motherhood was something very worthwhile. The fact that what you give to those children is going to benefit society, and they've all become very self-giving type of professions, you know, doctor, lawyer, journalist, nurse. So they, I think, feminism is, they're going down the wrong track, especially being anti-male. men, well, I suppose I'm very lucky that I've had a very supportive husband, and he basically didn't want me to work because he wanted me to concentrate on bringing up the kids. So for a while, like, I was thinking, oh, I'd much rather be out working and not home changing nappies and da-da-da. But now I see, you know, the love that I put into those kids has benefited all their own children and the whole of society, you know.
True. So, Olivia, have you got anything that you wanted to add?
I'm going a bit off on a tangent, but I was recently at a child protection seminar for work. I'm a teacher, and I just remember being shocked by the contradiction of the law in education, because, for instance, we were told that if a student comes to school and says, oh, my dad's beating up my mum and she's pregnant, as a mandatory reporter, I have to report that because for the welfare of that unborn child. And yet a doctor whose profession it is to uphold life can, you know, rip that baby apart. It just seems so contradictory that, you know, the day after, like while it's in utero, we have to support it. Under those guidelines, yet a doctor can, I don't know, there's just so many. It just seems absurd.
Yeah. I was listening to a girl the other day on a podcast, and she was saying that, I mean, how many, 50,000? Is that too little?
No, in Australia.
Abortion.
Yeah.
Oh, over 120,000 a year, isn't it?
No, 50 million in the United States since. Roe versus Wade. 50 million babies have been killed. So with the statistics like that, you have to assume that most people you know have had one, have either had one or is directly affected by abortion.
Mm.
So we have to be very sympathetic and very, you know, caring because they're our friends, they're our mothers, they're our grandmothers, they're our aunties. And they are hurting. They're aching. Do you have any, because you're such a compassionate woman, do you have any advice on how to speak
to people who are either considering abortion or who have had an abortion?
Well, one woman that I tried to help, I did face-to-face counselling with her, and she basically was from Turkey. English was a second language. She had been working in Australia and living here for many years, but she had nobody supporting her to have that baby. The father of the baby had told her he was unattached to anybody. When she got pregnant, he said he was married with three children and that she had to have an abortion. Then she'd been, she was under a psychologist at the time who she went to see, and he said, you have to have an abortion. You're not going to be able to cope with this. She rung her mother in Turkey. Her mother said, if you don't have an abortion, I'll never talk to you again.
How old was she?
She was 39. And she'd never been pregnant before or anything. And, I think basically she had very bad morning sickness, and she was unable to work, like, because of that. And so I just gave her money because to pay for her rent and things. And a couple of days later, she went to the abortion clinic. She couldn't go through with it. She came back. Then she just, after speaking to her mother, she just went back again. She said to the abortionist, is there any other option? It was hard for me to tell her what the effects are going to be afterwards, because all she could think was the present, here and now.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said, no, you've got no options. You won't have any money. You've got no father for the baby. You've got no family support, da-da-da. And she didn't know me from a bar of soap, even though I said I'd support her. But anyway, she went through with it. And she, from that day onward, she has had incurable pain, like it's called psychosomatic, it's fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. She hasn't been able to work since she had the abortion. She, whenever I go and meet up with her for lunch and that occasionally, if there's a little toddler around, she'll start crying. And I feel guilty, like, having my grandchildren around when she's there, because she just, it brings back all these memories. And I tried to get her to have post-abortion counselling, because there are professionals in that area.
Rachel's Vineyard, is it?
Not actually, just starting with weekly sessions that were free. Yeah. They were free to her. And she got a parking fine the first day. And because she didn't have any money, to pay parking fines and things, like, she just didn't go back. And I've told her about Rachel's Vineyard and things, but she's just so severely depressed that I can't motivate her to do much. But anyway, after 9 years since she had the abortion, she's just packed up and gone back to Turkey. But she says she's coming back.
Mm.
Anyway.
I think it's love to love them.
Yeah.
You know, we're all broken and we've all made mistakes. Mm. And to show them that they matter. And their pain matters.
Mm. That's the thing. Nobody else would recognize.
No one acknowledges that.
She went back to the psychologist, and he would not recognize that the abortion had caused her to become so debilitated.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Okay.
What's that book? There is a book.
Giving
Sorrow Words.
Yeah. What was that? Melinda Tankard Reese. That was that opened my eyes completely to the
post-traumatic stress of abortion.
But the abortion, the decision is normally not the woman. It comes from outside influence. Pressure. It comes from pressure from family, from the partner. You know, they're not the one, you have this life inside you. You're changed completely, whether you realize it or not.
Yeah.
And, I mean, no matter what anyone says, I think deep down that it's a life. And I know, like, when I've had a miscarriage, that still affects me, and that was 10 years ago. And it still affects my children, especially my little girl. So, we do know that it's a life, but these poor parents that have, considering abortion or have gone through with it,
they have to find a way to justify it, and hence a lot of them, you know, say it's not a human life.
Well, they're constantly in denial. Oh, it didn't affect me. I'm fine. Mm. But deep down, they know.
And sometimes it's not immediate either. You know, like Joy's mum, it can rear its head 40 years later.
But it sits there bubbling away. You know, and it comes out in certain things or triggers like children or anniversaries and birthdays that they would have had. And
they remember the birthdays.
Yeah.
And like this little bub that I saw with spina bifida, a lot of women these days, sometimes it's through choice of a partner, but a lot of times the babies have a medical condition and they're told to abort because of that.
Julie, you have a son who's Down syndrome. Were you ever, was it suggested?
Well,
or the doctor knew your stance?
It wasn't picked up. No, well, I would have said no because both my husband and I believed every child had a right to life, and no matter what disability, and we both worked with children with Down syndrome. But the thing is that it wasn't picked up during the pregnancy, even though I was telling the doctor he wasn't as strong, and his kicks and that was so different.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, but
wait, did you feel less sick? Because you know how they say, oh, being sick is a sign of a healthy baby.
No, I had hemorrhaging at the beginning, but I had that with quite a few pregnancies. But so just the ultrasound didn't pick it up. You can have more invasive testing and that probably would have picked it up. But usually with all the women I know who've got children with Down syndrome, the ultrasound has picked it up early on, and then they're offered more invasive testing. Although nowadays the testing's getting more and more simple. But I didn't know he had Down syndrome until he was born, and both my husband and I could see it. Neither of us said anything because we were in shock. And then 3 hours later, the pediatrician came in and basically told me every single thing that could happen. Every negative thing that could happen with having a child with Down syndrome, like as if to say, well, you know, this is what is going to be your life.
Yeah.
And basically I cried all night and thinking he was going to die because of all these complications that they can have.
Did he have a hole in his heart? Because I know that, is that one of the?
Yeah, that's something. But that I've had a baby sister die with a hole in the heart. She didn't have Down syndrome, you know. But just because it has Down syndrome and can have other complications, they don't have a right to live like it. It just doesn't make sense because there's so many other. It's only because they can pick up Down syndrome and eliminate it. Like in Iceland, they boast of 100% freedom of Down syndrome in their country.
Gosh.
But
what a poorer society for not having Down syndrome people in it. I don't think anybody who has ever come in contact with somebody with Down syndrome has walked away without a smile on their face.
Sure, that's right.
They're always so honest, for one. I think that's what makes you laugh, because they're brutally honest and loving.
Actually, Julie, I don't know if I've told you this, but Julie's daughter Kath is a good friend of mine, and Kath came around to visit once, and we pulled up, and Kath had Tom, your Down syndrome son, with her, and we pulled up at the same time, and my husband, he arrived home with shopping bags, and Tom was sitting at the table, and he said, hi, I'm Tom, and the chips in that bag look really nice. very honest. So out came the chips, and Tom enjoyed them.
I'm sure he let you know how much he enjoyed them too.
Oh, bless.
But it's just what message does it send to people who have other disabilities? Like, if they don't want people with Down syndrome who are physically able, but, you know, these people in wheelchairs and with, you know, who have accidents and cars and sports and they're paralysed, like, should we just euthanise them because they're causing some suffering, or we think they're suffering?
Well, this Gianna girl, she said that
her cerebral palsy is a tremendous gift. Like, she's so grateful for the gift of life despite the physical hardships.
Mm.
That's true.
Well, I think any hardships make, if you, they're a challenge, and if you face those challenges and try to overcome them, it makes you a stronger, better person, a more caring person. And if we eliminate all suffering from our lives, we're going to be so selfish and proud. And
but who's to say whose life is better than another? Like, we're so PC on, you know, not discriminating against anybody with any sexual preferences. Why are we discriminating on whose life is better, like life?
Physicality.
Yeah, but even I can't even think of the word. But I can't think of it. It'll come to me.
Yeah. So I mean, and these. Well, I know a nurse who there were three over the years. She lived in Hornsby. I think she went to Hornsby Hospital. So three babies with Down syndrome were born, and they were ill at the time, and they were abandoned by their parents, basically.
At the hospital?
At the hospital, yes. And so she adopted these three children, and she and her sister have brought them up. And that that brings meaning and happiness into their lives. They love to help others. And, you know, if these kids were eliminated, their lives would be empty probably. I've heard of a couple that were farmers who have also adopted three children with Down syndrome. So you'd think if they had one with Downs and it was such a huge burden, they wouldn't go on and take another two on, you know.
Right. So, oh, how beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah. So thank you so much for humbly sharing your story with us.
It's a pleasure.
It was so lovely for you to be on the podcast. I'm going to finish. Oh, before we, should I do the prayer first? No.
Before what?
We'll do, joy.
Oh.
What? So on the podcast, Julie, we go through something that's brought us joy this week.
Okay.
All right. So do you want to have a think about it, or you're right? Okay. You go first.
Yesterday was my son with Down syndrome's 31st birthday.
Gosh.
And it just made me so joyful because his siblings came from all over Sydney on a weeknight to celebrate his birthday.
Was he as proud as punch?
Oh, yes, he loves his siblings, you know. And they all love him, and it gives you a reason to live when you've got somebody like that who really needs you, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so they were all so generous.
I can't believe he's 31. That makes me old.
Anyway, what about you?
My joy would have to be school holidays. I just love just the no routine, spending time with the kids without that, you know, having to yell at them in the morning to get ready. Just, I can't wait. 3 weeks off with the kids. That's my joy.
Lovely.
Jess, what about you?
Well, I said at the beginning yesterday, I sat in bed and I read, locked the door, and I said, don't come in. I'm reading One Beautiful Dream by Jennifer Fulweiler. It's a rollicking tale of family chaos, personal passions, and saying yes to them both. And it's $1.99 on iBooks at the moment in Kindle. So get it. It is so funny. Geez. She's an atheist. She was an atheist, and she converted, and she had six kids in 8 years.
Wow.
And it is hilarious.
And you just One Beautiful Dream by Jennifer who?
Fulweiler, F-U-L. I'll put it in the show notes, W-I-L-E-R, Fulweiler. Okay. But it's $1.99. It's a steal. Go and buy it and have a great holiday reading it.
Good. I'll get that one.
Yeah, it's really fun. So before we end, we'll close with a prayer and pray for all those women who are considering abortion, who have had abortions, and just for women in general and our brokenness. Dear Father, thank you for never giving up on us. Even in our bitterness and our anger, you love us. In our pain and our shame and sorrow, you love us. You aren't dismayed by our brokenness, nor are you turned away by our messy lives. You love us and you seek to heal us. Father, I pray for those who have broken hearts. I pray for those who have secrets of rejection and abandonment. And I pray your tender and gentle light to dawn in our hearts. Please come and be with us where we are. Amen.
Amen. Beautiful. Have a lovely
week. Have a great week. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you. That's great.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.